Welcome to the Fall 2019 Women's Study. This session, we will be studying the wonderful Old Testament book Joshua and God's faithfulness through all aspects of life. For those of you who have attended previous studies, I beg your patience as I would like to address the general methodology of the study and the changes. As you can see, there is one rather visible change. I'm standing up here and not Marie. Marie is embarking on a mentorship program with the women of LCBC. Several of us will be supplementing Marie's awesome teaching by taking some of the lessons. We ask for your prayers and support as we take on this opportunity. For those of you who are new to the study, this is the process. We begin with an opening prayer and lecture. Questions are generally rhetorical unless a response is specifically requested. The lecture will run approximately 45 minutes, followed by a short break. The second half of the study is a small group study. You will have been assigned a table which will consist of a discussion leader and the members. During this period, the homework will be reviewed. This is a wonderful time for discussion, asking questions, and general fellowship. Each table has its own style, so your leader will expand on the specifics of your group. Today's lecture will be a historical review, and the intent is to help provide the historical background that will flesh out those events that have brought mankind to this point in the history of God's interaction with his creation. If history is not your cup of tea, I beg your indulgence and hopefully will move you to an appreciation, if not an outright enthusiasm, from understanding of scripture in black and white to technicolor. To open our study of the book of Joshua, I would like to take you back to the beginning. The beginning is the Creator God seeking to build a relationship with his creation, and Scripture is his record of that process. His creation was perfect, relationship perfect, but God rebelled, man rebelled, and that dynamic ever changed. Then began a slow process of establishing relation with a small nation out of all the humans throughout time, a nation for whom submission and praise was not compulsory, but the only reasonable response. Such a nation would require a land dedicated to the Lord and unwelcoming to anyone or anything that would defy or compete with a Creator God. Because humans had rebelled and therefore had a corrupted view of themselves and God, he would patiently work with humanity, never compromising his holiness. Unlike our world today, where everything requires instant gratification, nothing happens quickly enough, and nothing seems to be an absolute but is glorified for its constant change, God and his relationship with his people never changes. Therefore, we're going to take a few minutes to overview how God developed his people, preparing them to receive a land where a nation would be established, the essential ingredient that had to be developed and is essential to every relationship, trust. Trust in who God is, what it means to be immutable, omnipotent, righteous, merciful, omnipresent, and vengeful. We will study the family tree and in so do get an insight into the gleaning of a few from many, the failures and successes of his people, unintended consequences of events. We will look at the land, used 157 times in the Old Testament, 46 in the first six books. Now God used land as a vehicle to develop his people, how the land aided, protected, and thwarted these people. Equally, we will see how time played an integral role in God's plan. Slides of the family trees will contain not only who begot whom, but green represents the lineage of Christ, red enemies of Israel, and other colors are people of focus on that slide. Slides of the land will help us to gain context not only for the event, but context to our world today. Slides of culture and topical information to add depth. We're looking at Adam. Adam's first sin not only irrevocably damaged the relationship between God and his creation, but the first foreshadowing of the necessity of blood to cover sin. Further, it set in motion the first murder, which occasioned the need for another son, Seth. Time exposed the corruption of the human heart, while a kernel of faith remained. A global flood functioned like the reset button on your computer. With Noah, Shem is beginning the line that will bring us both Abram and Lot. Ham, the youngest son, shamed his father, but the punishment did not fall to Ham, but to his son Canaan and his sons. In the future, his sons' tribes would become thorns to Israel. Noah's son Cush would beget Nimrod, who distinguished himself before the Lord as a mighty hunter. And Nimrod foolishly sought to build a tower, reaching to the heavens, a monument to pride and reputation, uniting all the tribes, but it engendered God's wrath, from which languages developed and dispersion began. We can now reasonably apply dates. It is about 2075 BC, And Terach begets three sons, Haran, Abram, and Nahor. Haran's son Lot would love the world more than God, requiring Abram's intervention through God to save him from Gomorrah's destruction. He sinfully begot Moab and Ben-Ami, the Moabite and the Ammonite tribes that would later harass Israel. Nahor would beget Laban and Rebekah. Rebekah became Isaac's wife. Laban begat Leah and Rachel, Jacob's wives, and would engender trials for Jacob. Abram would become Abraham, the God, the father of God's nation. Abraham would beget Esau and Jacob. Abraham's journey. God directs Abraham, a fearful man, to go to Canaan. Abram, Sarai, Terach, and Lot leave Ur and begin a journey stopping 600 miles away at Haran. Upon Terach's death, 75-year-old Abram resumes his travels through Shechem, Bethel, ending in Beersheba in the Negev. A famine drives Abram to Egypt. This was done without God's direction, and the results in a fearful Abram passing off Sarai as his sister to protect himself. The Lord extricates them, and they return to the Negev. The Lord again reassures Abram he will become the father of nations and Sarai the mother. Their names change to Abraham and Sarah. They would have a son. Abram, now 100, and Sarah, 90, weak in faith, human in nature, determined to help God out. Abram impregnates Hagar, Sarah's servant, and Sarah, using a cultural tradition, changes Ishmael as her son. Therefore, God's plan was achieved. Not. This highly dysfunctional family is used by God to produce Isaac from Sarah. Abraham's revitalized faith brings him into submission, and his faith has grown so strong, he's willing to sacrifice his son Isaac to the Lord. But mercifully again, a foreshadowing of the blood sacrifice for sin is displayed through the substitution of a ram for Isaac's life. Ishmael would be blessed by God, but move east to Paran. Let's look at Isaac's journey. 50 years after arriving in Canaan, we're now in Shechem, still aliens surrounded by idolatry, worshiping Moloch, Ashtaroth, Baal, and many household gods. Isaac requires a wife, so Abraham sends a servant to bring a wife from the extended family in Padan Aram. Rebekah is brought back. Isaac, a fearful man, moves to Gerar. Famine hits the land, but God forbids finding relief in Egypt. Rather, for his obedience to God's laws and statutes, he would be protected from the Philistines, a powerful enemy. His descendants would be given these lands as promised to his father Abraham. Isaac prospered, grew wealthy with many flocks under God's protection. The Philistines grew envious, and disputes over water arose. Isaac moves to Beersheba. The Lord appears in a dream, reassuring him that he would have a multitude of descendants. The twins. Twins Esau and Jacob are born. Esau, firstborn, favored his father Isaac. Jacob, favored by Rebekah. Keturah birthed six sons, including Midian, who would later plague the Israelites. The twins turn 40. Esau opts to marry two Hittites rather than travel to Paran Aram. Isaac's health is failing. Jacob, the layer of snares, tricks his half-blind father into giving him his blessing and the firstborn's inheritance. Esau agrees to wait until Isaac's death before killing Jacob. Rebekah secrets Jacob off to Haran under the guise of seeking a wife, expecting to be gone only a few days. Esau would later beget Amalek, who would be another thorn in Israel's side. Jacob's journey. A duplicitous, fearful man travels to Haran. During this travel, he had the famous dream, Jacob's Ladder, in which the Lord assured him he would be blessed, his descendants inheriting the land, and from which all families of the earth would be blessed. Jacob remained 20 years in the employ of his uncle Laban. The game of trickery and deceit filled their lives. Jacob acquired two wives, Leah and Rachel, after 7 years' work for each. While Laban attempted to unfairly profit from Jacob's work, God protected Jacob, and each grew wealthy. Jacob heads home with his family and livestock. Obedience still nebulous, they sneak away while Laban is shearing his flock. Rachel steals a household god secreted in her camel's saddlebag. Laban catches up after 3 days. God, having instructed Laban not to harm Jacob, they part amicably. Fearful Jacob encounters Esau, seeking God's protection, but then resorting to bribery to assuage Esau. God renamed Jacob Israel after wrestling through the night. and he settles in Shechem. Duplicitous, fearful Israel, again showing favoritism to his son Joseph, results in him producing sons with serious foibles. His prophecy at the end of his life catalogs their sins. Reuben loses firstborn inheritance after shaming Israel, like Ham had done, by sleeping with Jacob's concubine. Simeon and Levi, full brothers, will be scattered in Promised Land, violent men who justified slaughter of the men of Shechem using Dinah's misfortune, yet Levi would birth Moses and Aaron. Judah would be praised. Descendants would dominate enemies, carry ruler's staff, and be known as the lion's whelp. Zebulun would dwell near water, prospering from sea trade, but not have land on the shoreline. Issachar would be industrious. Dan the aggressive would not be known for either moral or religious faithfulness. His name would not be recorded among the nations in Revelation 7, 4 through 8. Gad the raider, situated in Transjordan, would be valiant fighters exposed to multiple invasions. Asher would bring beauty, specializing in gourmet delights. Naphtali, as fleet as a deer, would be known for military prowess and hailed by Deborah and Barak in Judges. Benjamin, renowned as excellent archers and slingers, both King Saul and the apostle Saul, or Paul, would descend from his line. Joseph would reflect growth in humility, mercy, management of hardship and hostility, climbing to prosperity in Egypt, securing safety for the family in Goshen in Egypt during famine. Known by four names of God, his legacy would reach to Samuel, born of Ephraim, and Gideon, born of Manasseh. Upon Jacob's death, Joseph received permission from Pharaoh to return Jacob's body to be buried in Machpelah in Canaan. Joseph lived 110 years, seeing three generations. You may want to refer to the handout on your table to keep track of the players. After the passing of Joseph, a new Pharaoh rose, not knowing the good the Israelites had done, but he only saw prosperity that should have been his, non-Egyptians who would surely side against him in the event of war. Pharaoh came up with several solutions, but God used them to advance his plan. Pharaoh's solution, enslave the population, work them to exhaustion, add construction projects. God's plan, they continue to multiply and actually grow stronger under the harsh conditions. Solutions, midwife, kill the male infants. God's plan, fearing the Israelite God, the midwives ignored the order, claiming the women were strong and birthed before the midwife arrived. Solution, everyone throw the baby boys in the Nile. God's plan, two Levite parents secret their three-month-old baby boy in a basket in the bulrushes of the Nile. So technically, he was thrown in the Nile. Pharaoh's daughter finds the infant and adopts him once he is weaned. She names him Moses. Moses is a young man, about 40 years old. Moses sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew and thinks himself unseen, strikes and kills the Egyptian. The next day, Moses is found out and flees to Midian, about 300 miles away, the land populated on the east side of the Gulf of Aqaba by Isaac's son. The hill country of Midian was excellent for shepherding, and Moses found himself helping young women competing with the shepherds for water at a well. Helping the women resulted in being brought to the home of the priest Jethro. Moses marries Jethro's daughter Zipporah, becomes a shepherd, and raises a family. Approximately 40 years later, the Egyptian king died, and the people of God cried out for relief. God heard, remembered, saw, took notice of their affliction, and his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Moses encounters the Lord in the burning bush. The lands that would be expelled. The Lord spoke and identified himself. He would lead his people to the land of milk and honey, currently occupied by the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites. Moses would be his spokesperson with Pharaoh. The Lord calls Moses to speak to Pharaoh, assuring Moses that he will be with him. We now witness God's patience, omnipotence, and mercy by identifying how things will play out beforehand. Being human, Moses bargains for time, looking for a way out. First, I'm of no account. How can I approach Pharaoh? The Lord reassures him he and the people will worship God at Mount Horeb or Sinai. The Lord didn't have one superpower, rather, he is omnipotent. Secondly, how could Moses speak to the Israelites? Why should they believe him? The people had been in Egyptian captivity for 400 years under numerous gods, what would he answer if they asked God's name? Answer, I am who I am, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the eternal God. Although Pharaoh would deny the request to allow the people to travel to the wilderness for 3 days to worship their God, in the end, under compulsion, he would not only let them leave, but the peoples would give them silver, gold, and they would essentially plunder Egypt. Moses, fearful that the people might see him as a false prophet, the Lord provides Moses with three further proofs. Throw your staff on the ground, it will become a snake. Grasp its tail, and it will become a staff. Slide your hand into your garment on your chest, remove it, and it will be leprous. Repeat the process, and the hand will be healed. Take water from the Nile, spill it on the dry ground, and the water will become blood. Third, not to be deterred, Moses comes up with another excuse. I'm not eloquent. I'm slow of speech. God will give Moses the words and teach him how to speak, but Moses begs off again. Lastly, Aaron, Moses' brother, was eloquent. The Lord assures Moses that upon their return, Aaron will support his brother. The Lord will provide the words to both. By his staff, Moses would exhibit these signs of authority. Jethro approves Moses' mission, giving him his blessing. The Lord previewed for Moses what would occur in his encounter with Pharaoh. Moses would perform all the wonders with the staff, but God would harden Pharaoh's heart 10 times, and Pharaoh also would harden his own heart 10 times. You shall then say, thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I say to you, let my son go that he may serve me. But if you refuse to let him go, behold, I will kill your son, your firstborn. Moses moves to Midian. It should be noted that Mount Sinai and Mount Horeb's location is disputed. Thus, the two routes for the return to Egypt will be using the blue route. Moses set off for Egypt with his wife Zipporah and the journey of about 300 miles. Aaron and Moses meet, and as the Lord had commanded, they spoke with the people, and they believed and worshiped. The request to allow the people a 3-day leave to worship their God in the wilderness is rejected by Pharaoh. Further, they would no longer have straw provided to them, but their quota would not be diminished. Failure to meet quota resulted in beatings. The people took out their anger on Moses and Aaron. In turn, Moses complained to the Lord. Now Moses attempted to persuade Pharaoh of the power of his God by turning his staff to a serpent, but the Pharaoh's conjurers and sorcerers were able to do the same. Thus began the 10 plagues that afflicted the Egyptians, but the Israelites were spared. Waters turned to blood for 7 days. A plague of frogs. Gnats plagued the earth. Swarms of flies. Livestock diseased and died. Boils and sores on man and beast, even the sorcerers and the conjurers. Hail killing beasts and crops exposed. Locusts denuded every tree and plant. Darkness so deep it was palpable covered the land for 3 days. Death of every firstborn animal and human. And still Pharaoh was not moved. The Lord strikes at the heart of the societal custom and tradition of all the peoples of the land, completely upsetting it. The firstborn, as we saw with Jacob and Esau, received a double portion. Additionally, the firstborn would ascend to the throne, maintain the dynasty. It held religious, political, dynastic, and societal ramifications. With this plague, Moses called all the elders and instructed them on the execution of the first Passover, including the application of blood on the lintels and the necessity to remain in their homes until morning to avoid disaster. At midnight, the Lord himself, most probably the angel of the Lord, passed through the land, and every home mourned as their firstborn died. The Lord foreshadows the perfect shedding of blood to fully redeem his people. As the cries of the people and his own household rose to a crescendo, Pharaoh calls out Moses and Aaron during the night. Pharaoh finally relented, "Go, all your people, flocks and herds, and bless me also." The Lord had exposed the impotence of the pagan deities, the loss of the firstborn animals striking at the many pagan gods represented by those animals. The first Passover was instituted on the 10th of the first month to be observed every year, and the story told to the children, lest they forget the power, majesty, and mercy of their Lord. As a yearly consecration, the firstborn, they would be sacrificed to the Lord. For the children and some animals, a ransom would substitute. starting off with the proper recognition of God's fulfillment to his people out of slavery and into their inheritance, God leads them out of Egypt. Moses and the Exodus. A cloud would lead the people during the day and a pillar of fire by night, a constant reminder day and night that the Lord was not just with them, but leading them. While the Israelites are camped at the shore of the sea, Pharaoh's heart is once again being hardened by the Lord, and Pharaoh, being bipolar, decides they are of no account and they will not be allowed to depart. Heading up 600 chariots with horsemen and soldiers, Pharaoh intends to run down the Israelites and drive them back to Goshen. A series of testings begin with the adage, seeing is believing, playing out. The Hebrews see the advance of the Egyptian chariots and soldiers bearing down on them, and their prayer to the Lord quickly turns to complaint, their fear immobilizing them. The pillar of cloud no longer encourages them, rather, Egypt seems the smarter option. But the testing of Moses bears fruit, and while the people cower, Moses stands firm. Remembering God's words to him, he chastises his people and reassures them that God will fight for them. God using the hardened heart of Pharaoh as a dramatic and visible way to evidence his power. The pillar of cloud moves between the people and Pharaoh. Moses obeys God's command and raises his staff over the sea. The east winds rise and the water is pushed back. Blowing all night, the seabed is dry and the people cross over, with a count of 600,000 men of fighting age 20 years and older. Adding women and children, we can estimate between 1.5 and 2 million Jews were crossing. Pharaoh, driven by blind hatred, presses his men forward, and the pillar of cloud and fire create confusion for the soldiers. On instruction from God, Moses again raises his hand at about sunrise, and the waters come rushing back over the Egyptians, while the people of God remain walking on dry ground. Pharaoh's army to a man was destroyed. The stories of this mighty work of God would be carried not only back to Egypt, but throughout the land of Canaan. Throughout the wandering, they see repeated failings of the people, as strong faith will be the essential component to taking the promised land. The wanderings will afford them many tests. These tests are accompanied by visible signs of God's presence in their midst, patience, mercy, and vengeance for rebellion. Before we get into this era of history, let's bring in a couple of notes concerning the human body. The human body can survive without water 3 to 5 days. By the second day, intellectual functions are seriously diminished. Hallucinations occur. By the third day, bodily functions begin to shut down. Mothers can no longer produce milk. As we know, infants and tots are much more quickly damaged by lack of water. The human body's ability to survive without food is longer, but again, with significant injury to the body as time passes. Survival about 8 to 12 weeks. Keeping this in mind, we begin to walk through the wilderness. The Israelites are now in the wilderness of Shur, the upper quadrant of the Sinai Peninsula, and it has been 3 days without water. The people grumbled and Moses interceded with the Lord. In gentleness, the Lord offers them a conditional promise. If they keep all his statutes and commandments, he will not afflict them with the diseases of Egypt. He is their healer. They were then blessed with 12 springs of sweet water and 70 palms bearing ripened dates. 2 months into the wandering, grumblings begin, and with typical hyperbole, they were professing that they would die of starvation, where in Egypt their pots were full. 4 times grumbling is repeated, drawing attention to their failing and evidence of God's patience, while also presenting an opportunity to experience God's glory. For 5 days, they would go out and gather 1 day's portion of manna. On the 6th day, they would gather 2 portions, as they were not to receive manna on Sabbath. God viewed his glory by his visible presence among his people through the appearance of manna. There would be no stockpiling of stores, as any excess would become foul. This, of course, did not prevent some from testing the rule. Lesson: their survival was dependent upon God, and God's word would not go unfulfilled. Taking the coastal route as the Lord commanded, they traveled from Sin to Rephidim. Upon arriving, the pattern repeats with grumblings to Moses. Moses beseeching the Lord and God displaying his glory. This time, Moses was to bring some of the elders to the rock at Horeb. Taking the staff used in the display of power in Egypt, Moses struck the rock at God's command, and the water issued forth. This would be the pattern for the people. We now see the entrance of Joshua into God's history and insights into the man himself. Amalek comes to Rephidim to wage war against Israel. The contrast between those we have considered so far, including Moses, and Joshua is startling. We will see no complaint, no second guessing. Rather, on Moses' instruction to attack Amalek, he gathers a force and proceeds to execute Moses' command. Let's look at this more closely. The Israelites had not been in battle for 400 years. As slaves, they had been further removed from the realities of war. Now, God had used the cruelty of Pharaoh to develop strong, tireless men capable of enduring long, tedious hours of labor. We can infer from Joshua's response that Joshua had learned through that endurance and the glory of God witnessed in their escape and the provision of food and water that Moses was God's appointed, and if Moses instructed him to go to battle, that God would be with him. And so he went to battle. God, in his mercy, omnipotence, and glory, instructed Moses to go atop a hill, visible to all, with hands raised. When this was done, Joshua prevailed. But when Moses faltered, Amalek would prevail. Aaron and Hur, Caleb's son, assisted Moses, supporting his hands and giving him a rock to rest upon. With this, Joshua's forces again took the advantage. The battle waged throughout the day, and Joshua overwhelmed Amalek. This humiliating defeat would not be forgotten. Moreover, the news of it spread far and wide, reaching into Midian, where Jethro heard. Moses was to write these events for further generations and to read the message to Joshua, as it would strengthen him for future events, recognizing that the victory was God's, not Joshua's, for no one could have gone into battle more poorly prepared than Israel. Now Jethro and family joined Moses in the wilderness and worshiped God for his greatness and mercy. Jethro further advised Moses in the developing of a chain of command in handling the various issues of the people. It was the third month when they left Rephidim and entered the wilderness of Sinai in front of the mountain. It is here that Moses met with God on Mount Sinai. Here the Lord gave the Ten Commandments, the ordinances, laws, feasts, property rights, the regulations for offering, the Ark of the Covenant, items of the tabernacle, priests and their garments. Sacrifices were established, all detailed in Leviticus. Also, the Lord explains on his mission in the Promised Land that the rules of engagement between God and his people, these rules were conditional. An angel, the pre-incarnate Christ, will guard their way, obey his voice. He will not pardon transgressions. If you truly obey, God will be an enemy to Israel's enemies, adversary to Israel's adversaries. Will bring Israel into the land of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Completely destroy them. Israel will not worship their gods, not serve the tribes, not do as they do, shall utterly overthrow them, break their sacred pillars to pieces. Serve the Lord your God, then he will bless your bread and water. Remove sickness, no carrying, miscarrying, or barrenness in the land. Fulfill your days, send my terror ahead of you, throw into confusion all people you meet, make them flee. Send hornets ahead to drive out the Canaanites, the Hittites, and the Hivites, but not in a single year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts too numerous. Drive them out little by little until you are fruitful and take possession of the land. The Promised Land. Boundaries will be fixed with the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines or the Mediterranean and from the wilderness to the Euphrates River. They will drive the inhabitants out of the land. Make no covenant with them, else you will sin against me. You will serve their gods. They will be a snare. Moses in the Exodus. Moses is called by God to meet with him on the mountain. He instructed the elders, Aaron and Hur, to remain with the people, but took Joshua, his servant, with him, though Joshua did not go into the cloud. There Moses spent 40 days with the Lord, receiving the commandments written with the finger of God. Once again, we see Joshua's unquestioning faithfulness as he remained alone, waiting Moses' return. Upon their descent, Joshua was first to hear a disturbance. We can infer that after 40 days, Joshua was still an alert, vigilant servant. Meanwhile, the weakness of the people resulted in the creation of a golden calf, reveling and dancing in their sin. The Lord would destroy them, but Moses, for a second time, reminds the Lord that the enemies of Israel and God should hear of this and bring dishonor on his name, as well as reminding him of his promise to make a great nation of them. Still, sin would not go unpunished, and Moses instructed the Levites to take up sword and kill every man, whether friend, family, or neighbor, from gate to gate. A total of 3,000 men were killed. Though many were killed, not all, for those who had sinned died. The remainder would be in judgment. I will blot them out of my book. It is interesting to note that Joshua was not in this group of men charged in executing punishment against the people of God. The people repented and removed their ornaments from Mount Horeb onward. Again, they were reassured that an angel would guard them on their way with the reiteration of the warning to obey, that transgressions will not be pardoned. God will drive out the enemies. The tent of meeting was set outside the camp, where God met with Moses. Joshua, his servant, would not leave his post at the tent. With the two tablets replaced and the covenant renewed, they continued their journey. At the second month of the second year of their wanderings, a census is again taken, except for the Levites, as they would not inherit land, but the priesthood. Only men 20 years and older and able to go to war were counted. Some tribes had increased, others decreased. Remember, we have gone through a battle and a cleansing, netting out to about 603,000 men. In the second month of the second year, they moved from Sinai to Paran wilderness, a three-day journey. The ark now traveled before them. Once again, the people complained. This time, they were tired of manna and wanted meat. The anger of the Lord was upon them. Some were consumed by his fire, and he plagued the people as he did in Egypt. Moses, exhausted, speaks with the Lord and says, "I give up. Just kill me." God relents and says he will give them 30 days of meat to gorge themselves on. Moses has hit his limit and questions the Lord. Seeing a mass slaughtering the livestock to achieve this promise, he's overwhelmed. The Lord chides him and says, "Am I powerless?" The Lord brings forth a wind, driving the quail inland. The quail surround the camp 3 feet deep, and the people began to gorge themselves. Before they could eat, they were struck with a very severe plague. Meanwhile, we see Joshua, concerned for the integrity of Moses' position, warning Moses that two of the selected elders were prophesying in the camp. Moses quiets his concern, explaining that it would be good if all the people were so imprinted with the Holy Spirit. The Lord instructs Moses to send one representative from each tribe to spy out the land that he will give them. Among these are Hoshea, aged 50, meaning salvation, whom Moses renames Joshua, meaning Jehovah is salvation, representing the tribe of Benjamin, and Caleb, 40 years old, representing the tribe of Judah as a Canaanite, absorbed into the tribe of Judah. They were to go to the Negev, use Kadesh Barnea as the launching point, traveling up to Rehov through the hill country. Let's look at a topographical map of the Promised Land to give you a better sense of where we are going and what they were dealing with. The gold lumps are the hill country. The cream colors are the foothills. They would be following the golden route, no pun intended. Note, this will give them a clear vision of the lands from the Mediterranean to the Transjordan. For a clear perspective, our Blue Ridge Mountains would be hill country in Israel, about 2.2 thousand feet above sea level. They were to take 40 days traveling a route identified by the red line. They were tasked with determining several key aspects. People, were they strong or weak? Determination, they were strong. Land, was it good or bad? It was determined to be good. Again, land, fat or lean? Again, determined to be fat. Cities, were they open or fortified? Fortified. Trees, were they many, few, or none? Positively, there were many. Fruit, was it plentiful and lush or poor? Positively, it was plentiful and lush. God providentially set this task in late summer, about the time of harvest, with rainfall about zero for several months. Upon their return, the 12 reported honestly. The people were strong and large, ranging 6 to 8 feet, renowned warriors, whereas the average Israelite was about 5'6". Take note that there were two questions concerning the land. The land was good, able to provide their animals and grow crops. The land was fat, meaning they would have abundance and live well. The cities, unfortunately, many were fortified. To conquer a fortified city could take 6 months to a year. The trees were plentiful at this time, and the fruits were plentiful and lush, as exhibited by the grapes that they brought back with them. Further fruits included dates and pomegranates. Further, they would have to deal with the Amalekites living in the Negev. We can deduce that on the journey back, there was a lot of discussion about the viability of coming into this land, as instead of reporting back to Aaron and Moses, the ten made their report into the presence of the entire congregation. Before we get down to the 10. Let's look at seeing is believing. This is what they saw. Compare preparedness for war. The Canaanites and the Philistines, for short range, they had hand-to-hand combat, iron swords, daggers, and spears. The Israelites, for short range, had staff, farm and household implements, and jawbones. At medium range, light spears and javelins, both iron-tipped, whereas the Israelites had shepherd's rods and slings. At long range, the Canaanites and the Philistines had heaving stones, bows, and iron-tipped arrows. Israelites' long range had bows, but their arrows were bronze or wood-tipped. The Canaanites and Philistines had support, shield-bearers and weapon-carriers. The Israelites had no support. For transportation in the lowlands, there were horses and chariots that were iron-plated. In the hills, there were horses. The Israelites had feet. The 10 reported to enter was folly. When Caleb spoke against them, assuring Moses that indeed they should go forward, he and Joshua were threatened with stoning for their efforts to dissuade the congregation, which of course immediately moved to doom and gloom and refused to move further. The victories of God's sovereign protection forgotten. Moses bears his soul to the Lord, exhausted at the lack of faith of his people. God's anger is raised and he threatens revenge through four generations for their inequity. Though Moses' intercession, the Lord promised punishment to be reduced to an extension of 38 years of wandering. All who were 20 plus at the Exodus would die in the wilderness, never to enter the promised land. The exceptions were Caleb and Joshua, because they had remained faithful to the Lord. Being made aware of their sentence for their unfaithfulness, they attempt to avoid the consequence by going up to the hill country. Despite Moses' warnings that they could not manipulate the Lord, and their efforts would be futile, they took on the Canaanites and the Amalekites. Neither the Lord nor the Ark of the Covenant went before them, and they were struck down. The Transjordan Conquests. For 38 years, they had wandered in the wilderness. They migrated up the Transjordan territories, but never crossed over the Jordan. During this period, God directed various battles against the inhabitants. In each of these battles ordained by God, they were successful. They passed through Edom, the land of Esau's descendants, but were not to provoke them, as this land had been given them by God. They were to buy food and water. Passing through Moab, likewise, they were not to provoke them, as God had given it to the Lot's sons. Nor were they to provoke the sons of Ammon, descendants of Lot, as this too had been given to them by the Lord. The Amorites the Lord gave into their hands, and the Lord would put dread into the hearts of their enemies. When Israel attempted to pass through Amorite lands offering to buy food and water, Sikun, king of the Amorites, refused to let them pass, for God had hardened his heart. Sikun came out in battle and was delivered into the hands by the Lord. These wars accomplished several things. They gained faith in the Lord. They developed military skills in the men who would enter the promised land. They would build livestock, cattle, sheep, donkeys from their plunder. They would acquire weapons of war from the conquered. The chain of command was developed within the army. The gold and jewelry were brought to the Lord in atonement. The closing of Moses' life. The Lord instructs Moses to bring Joshua before Eleazar the priest and the congregation and commissions him in their sight, a man in whom the Spirit exists. The Lord commanded Moses to go up against the Midianites, and Israel is victorious against the five kings of Midian. All the men were killed, the boys were killed. Women who had had intimacy were killed. Virgins and little girls were given to members of Israel. Joshua and Eleazar would divide the lands among the tribes, minus the Levites. The Levites would not own land, but would control 48 cities. Six cities would be set aside as cities of refuge. Those guilty of manslaughter would be safe as long as they remained within the walls. Now Moses was not to enter the promised land, but why? Upon the death of Miriam, the people again assaulted Moses and Aaron in the complaint of no water, we'll all perish. The Lord spoke to Moses, telling him to take his rod, Aaron and all the congregation, and speak to the rock. It'll yield its water. Moses, hot under the collar, takes Aaron and the people before the rock and chastises them and declares, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? Moses then struck the rock twice with his rod, probably in a fit of frustration and anger at the people. But the Lord will not be diminished. Moses failed to trust God as was told. In response, Moses would not bring the people into the promised land. and so he died at 120 years of age, eyes clear and full of vigor. He was buried in Moab, no one knowing the place of his burial. But the Lord was merciful as he took Moses up Mount Nebo, opposite Jericho, and allowed him to gaze at the promised land. The page turns, and Joshua, born in Egyptian captivity, tested by the Lord in the wanderings, attendant of Moses and warrior, aged 90, prepares to bring God's people into his promised land, where he will lead them for 20 years, dying at the age of 110. He was the son of Nun, filled with the spirit of wisdom from the laying on hands by Moses. The sons of Israel would listen to him and do as the Lord had commanded Moses. Although they would take strongholds throughout the land promised by God, they would fail to complete God's commission, never fully occupying the lands, driving out all the occupants, though there was peace at this time. The failure to complete God's plan would become a plague on future Israel. The author is not identified, but the consensus is most would have been written by Joshua between 1385 and 1405 BC, with a few passages likely written after his death, but included in the book because of close connection. Joshua may well have hoped his word would be both a warning and an encouragement. God is faithful to his promises. God enables the impossible. God will punish unfaithfulness. There is a drumbeat of be strong and courageous, be strong. The people are to enter the promised land, conquer the land, apportion the land, summoned to covenant and loyalty with the Lord. And yet Joshua too would bend under the yield of the mantle of leadership and yield to the temptation to run ahead of God. The people would succumb to temptation and grow weary and cautious. With this as the backdrop, we enter the book of Joshua. Thank you for your attention.